We arrive here today to debate at social distances from each other.
There's no doubt that the old politics of the two-party system is now gone and over.
I don't need lectures from you or anybody on the Sinn Féin side of the house.
We're very reluctant to kind of say what's red lines, but we do have to take climate seriously.
There's going to be constant criticism, there's going to be a lot of disappointment, and whoever goes into government is going to be unpopular. Okay.
Hello and you're very welcome to Your Politics podcast from RTE News. I'm Paul Cunningham. Joining me in studio today is RTE's political reporter Sandra Hurley. Hello, Sandra.
Hi, Paul.
Micheál Lehane has taken the day off, which is a shock and disgrace. What do you think?
That's just unbelievable. I don't know who sanctioned that.
Outrageous. I have to have a word with the boss. Our political guest today is Fianna Fáil's James Lawless. Hello, James.
Hello, folks. How are you?
Thanks very much for joining us today. Let's start off with the big question. You represent, am I correct, North Kildare?
That's right, yeah.
And then there's South Kildare. Is there two Kildares?
There actually is, in a way, because North Kildare, where I represent, I suppose I'm sort of in the middle. I live in Salins, just outside Naas. We would be prime commuter belt, but we still have room for some horsey country and some green space and some agriculture, but North Kildare is almost like an extension of Dublin in parts. When you come out from Dublin West, cross the Liffey Bridge into Leixlip, and Leixlip, Selbridge, Maynooth, the large urban areas, quite built up, you know, in many ways, becoming a suburb of Dublin. When you head down south, you are down places like Athy, which are bordering on Carlow, and then you're really into farm country, open fields, that sort of thing. So there's definitely a sense of it, but as I say, I'm kind of in the middle.
Straddling both camps, he said diplomatically and politically.
And very much in the commuter heart. And actually, that's how I got into politics. I was a frustrated commuter 20 years ago, waiting for a train that was always late. And I said, well, I'm going to do something about this. Got a group going, organised, and seemed to be good at getting results. And the rest is history, as they say.
Well, tell us, as far as I understand, I was just looking at your bio there. You started off with an interest in mathematics, got into IT finance, which makes sense, then took a right-hand turn into law and became a legislator. So does the train issue dovetail and explain how you managed to move from IT and finance to become a TD?
It does, really, I suppose. Yeah, my academic career, I think I have three primary degrees and a couple of diplomas. And yeah, I did maths, physics, moved on to IT and later into law. But really, my political interest, part of it is history. Part of it, I was always interested in and sort of how we got to where we are as a society, as a nation, as a state, as a planet. And then I was very much living in Semidealand, just bought my first house, just getting married, living in commuter land, getting the train into work every morning and dealing with all those issues, I suppose, for the first time, but dealing with them for real. And I felt that, look, someone's got to do something about this. And at local level first, residence committees, setting up a commuter rail group, campaigning for more green space for, you know, the family that I was about to have. And I suppose one thing led to another, and that, you know, got onto the council and then ran for the Dáil.
And here you are.
Here I am, exactly, yeah.
Well, you're now, the difference between your first and second term is that you're now in government. Fianna Fáil is holding really interesting briefs. You know, we've got housing, you've got health, and obviously you also hold the Taoiseach's office. But just on that issue of health, the sort of the burning issue this week has been the question of the National Maternity Hospital moving to the St. Vincent site. Where do you stand on this issue?
Yeah, so just before I get on to the issue itself, I suppose just you make an interesting point. In the last term, I was in opposition and very much was in opposition. The confidence of supply was an arrangement, but we opposed the government on many issues, campaigned against them on many issues.
Sinn Féin wouldn't see it that way, James. They'd say you were tooth by jowl in bed with Fine Gael.
Yeah, but they're completely incorrect and wrong about that. And I campaign against fake news, amongst other things, in the last Dáil. And Sinn Féin are great charlatans and purveyors of fake news when it suits them. We had no ministers, we had no Taoiseach's office, we had no Taoiseach's office, we had no access to, preferential access. You know, we were like any other opposition TD going into the chamber each day. But I suppose one thing I just say, I suppose, is a technical point, but the party's in government, but I'm not part of the government. There's 15 ministers and there's a number of junior ministers of state. But there's a number of us, obviously, we're allied with the government and we're parties in the government. But I chair the Justice Committee and, you know, we exert a degree of independence from time to time as well. And
as a committee member, but you're a loyal Fianna Fáil TD who's part of the government, yeah?
Oh, very much so, very much so. But having said that, I'm very aware of my constitutional duty to be accountable to the legislature and to the Oireachtas, certainly in committee matters, you know, and I think I've discharged that pretty well. I think it's important that we do that.
Okay.
But anyway, you asked me about the National Maternity Hospital. So look, this issue is, I suppose, has really blown up again in the last couple of weeks. And it's a real quagmire. And a couple of things, I suppose, occurred to me. The first one is that we appear as a state, look, going back through a couple of different administrations, to have committed significant resources, planning effort, logistics, legal paperwork and capital to getting this project up and going where it is. So the first point I suppose I'd make is there would be losses in every sense if we had to uproot now and go a different direction, if it was to change course or change location, I suppose, putting it more bluntly. I don't think that's really on the cards. However, there's a very real difficulty presenting with this ownership issue that's coming up on the lands. Now, it should be a public hospital on public lands. There is this kind of legal dancing on the head of a pin, or angels dancing on the head of a pin might be an appropriate analogy to figure out who exactly is going to own the lands at the end of the day. Is it a 99-year lease? Who is on the board? Is it a separate company to the church? You know, what stake do they have? I suppose we're coming out of a legacy period where, for the last century, really before the big state, we delegated education, health, to a lesser degree, housing. A lot of the big picture issues were delegated, not just in Ireland, but internationally, to the church and to charities. And we've seen, particularly in Ireland, but again, in other countries, Canada is a recent example, we've seen negative results. We've seen some positive results. You know, we saw provision of church education and sure, healthcare, etc. But we look, obviously, with things like mother and baby homes, the industrial schools, and we've had our fill, I suppose, of those scandals in Ireland. So we're particularly sensitive to it here. The other thing I'd say is we are a republic. Okay, albeit the Bunong na Héireann constitution did have initially as recognition of the church, but that's actually been moved on. We've moved on from that since and ever since. And I think as a republic, we have to separate church and state. We have to do so in every sense, and particularly when it comes to...
I'm just wondering about that. I mean, Micheál Martin has the opportunity as Taoiseach to make a defining decision that the state will not invest in a hospital or any other form of substantial infrastructure unless it both owns the building and owns the land. And he could make that decision, and then basically St. Vincent's group will have to make up its mind on the basis of that. But if he makes that like principal decision, then everything else follows from it. So I'm just wondering whether you think he should take that step as was urged upon him by the co-leader of the Social Democrats, Róisín Shortall.
Yeah, so look, I suppose I don't have any inside knowledge as to his thinking at the moment. And as I mentioned a minute ago, you know, I'm not sitting in a cabinet for these discussions, but it looks to me to be going that way. I think we're heading for a standoff between the government and the Board of Vincent's Hospital. You know, I think there's been some discussions. I suppose there's been heavy hints in the Dáil and in other media in the last couple of days. There's been conversations, some of which started off as being private, but ended up being reported, which would suggest similarly. So I think maybe that kind of standoff is coming.
But would you like him to? I know you can't understand or know what he's thinking, but just at a personal level, would you like him to?
Well, let's see what it's going to cost, first of all, because principle can be very expensive. And if we've committed hundreds of millions to this project, if we've committed years to this project already, it may not be simple as just saying, well, I'm going to take a stand and stand by the Republic and, you know, burn the bridges and cost the state maybe a couple of billion on top of that.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact figures. The other thing I'd say, you know, and I've acknowledged that there are serious legacy issues about the church's involvement in many services in Ireland. The other thing I'd say is, if you want to be offended, you can be very easily offended about anything. And some of the examples I've heard from some left-wing opposition members in recent days seem to be taking sort of forms of treatment, or, you know, forms of surgery, which, you know, are important and are needed in certain cases, but would probably be not the majority of procedures carried out in any hospital. And I suppose trying to extrapolate a situation where if a particular patient needed a particular type of surgery and a religious order had some influence on the board somewhere, that maybe that could permeate down and that particular surgery may not be permitted. I think we're sort of looking, you know, if you want to find a fringe case, you can always find one.
Yeah.
And I think really we've got to look at this in the round as value for money for the taxpayer, as a bigger picture project. But I am confident a way would be found, because as I say, I do think we need to separate church and state and stand by the Republic, and I think I expect that will happen.
Sandra Hurley, if I can bring you in to broaden the context beyond Fianna Fáil here, I mean, Leo Varadkar has been somewhat in the centre of this. It was a question posed by Breed Smith of People Before Profit, which sort of triggered this discussion which has been rolling for a couple of weeks. Where does it currently stand?
Yes, I think, well, just on that point, I suppose some would say that was curious timing on Leo Varadkar's part. This issue has been rumbling along and it has been raised many times by various opposition TDs, but Leo Varadkar answered it so clearly and illustrated, as he saw it, the unhappiness with some elements of the project last week. And various members of the opposition would think that perhaps he was doing that because of the by-election in Dublin Bay South. The new hospital is going to be in that constituency, and perhaps it was an opportunity to sort of position Fine Gael as in some way sharing the misgivings of other parties, and that perhaps that might help their candidate during the campaign. But where does it stand now? It is a big mess. There's no easy solution here. They have reached an impasse. I think there is a standoff between Vincent's and the government. We've kind of been here before. I think there's a bit of a turf war with St. Vincent's. There was a really big row some years ago over top-up payments for medical executives, and that was very difficult as well. And I think that it's just not easy to see where it can go. I think there's a difference in tone amongst some members of the government. Stephen Donnelly certainly feels that he has got total guarantees on the procedures to be carried out in this hospital. And I think he would also feel that while the preferred option is to buy the land, if you can't do that, he says the 150-year lease would be acceptable. However, I think politically, the reality now is that that lease option just isn't going to fly.
Sandra just mentioned, James, the question of Dublin Bay South and the by-election that's upcoming. You were on the stump, I saw on Twitter in recent days. What did you pick up?
Yeah, so look, the election is on and there were teams canvassing across the constituency. I was out a couple of nights during the week. We were wearing green jackets for Deirdre Conroy, out backing a good, strong candidate there and our councillor. And a couple of doors actually thought we were the Green Party because they saw the green livery and said, oh, you're the Greens. And we said, no, we're Fianna Fáil. I'm not sure if that was
this
made
subterfuge.
For a better or...
trying to broaden your base, James.
I'm not sure if that was made for a more or less welcome reaction. I suppose it depended on what door we were on. But look, certainly the election is underway. Just when you talk about the Taoiseach's remarks there about the hospital, and I suppose he's known for, I suppose, venturing maybe off script on occasion, I suppose I was a bit more tickled at his remarks at the Fine Gael Ardéisle last week when he committed to all kinds of spending promises, including on health, that I think was at 4 billion extra per year for health. And I know the Taoiseach took that, with, I suppose, with something of a grain of salt on Tuesday afternoon in the Dáil. And he said, well, it's news to Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath. So I thought that was interesting. But look, I think one thing on a serious note that the pandemic has taught us is the big state, I think, is here to stay because we've realised that we pledged billions upon billions to the cause, I suppose, the national solidarity of keeping the state alive, of business supports, of employment supports, of things like the pandemic payment, welfare supports. And really, I don't see us unravelling. Of course, some of the particular supports will be unwound. But I think that as the concept of a big state, I think, is here to stay. So I suppose I welcome Fine Gael to that church. Fianna Fáil were always there, but now we've managed to convince our coalition partner quicker than we thought as to our way of thinking.
Who knew? Just because we were mentioning Dublin Bay South, I just best read out the other candidates who are running there in that by-election. Ivana Bacic for the Labour Party, Lynn Boylan for Sinn Féin, James Gagan for Fine Gael, Sarah Durkin for the Social Democrats, Mairead Tobin for Aintu, Bridget Purcell for People Before Profit, Claire Byrne for the Green Party, Manix Flynn, Independent, Justin Barrett, National Party, Peter Dooley, Independent, and Jackie Gilburn for Renew. You were talking about big state and the question of COVID. We are next week looking at the possibility of a further reopening and easing of restrictions in which indoor dining will be allowed, pubs will be reopened and people allowed to go inside rather than having to stay outside. What's your gut feeling about this trajectory of the Delta variant? Because it would appear, if you're just looking at the tea leaves, that this could get pushed, this could be delayed.
Yeah, well, my take on it, I suppose, is this so far. I had hoped, and I was speaking to people like Adrian Cummins of the Restaurants Association in recent weeks, I had been optimistic a few weeks ago and I thought maybe the schedule could even be accelerated given that the vaccination programme is now going exceedingly well, given the outdoor dining has taken off with a bang, given things seem to be going pretty well so far until Delta came on the scene. So I was of the view, and I sort of had been suggesting to ministers, look, I wonder could we actually bring this thing forward? And I suppose the first thing I'd say is that's not going to happen now. I mean, you know, whatever about slowing it down, it's certainly not going to be sped up in terms of the reopening. Look, I suppose we'll see in the next week or so what happens as regards the 5th of July deadline. But one thing I noticed in comments in the last day or two is that government, and I welcome this personally, seem to be asserting, I suppose, a degree of independence from the public health advice at this stage.
Why is that a good thing?
I think it's a good thing because I think if you look around a table, if we have a weather emergency, we have a national emergency response team, and we've met Aaron in the room absolutely telling us all about what gales and storms are going to come on top of us or what blizzard or snow is expected. But we also have economic people. We also have logistical people, we might have people in local authorities from a roads management perspective, we transport people. We have the whole spectrum in the room rather than one particular discipline. One particular discipline that may not be particularly accustomed to managing large-scale operations and managing all that goes with it. We had a very interesting conversation on the Justice Committee, which I chair. We had a very interesting discussion on Tuesday afternoon about, I suppose, managing the pandemic from a civil liberties point of view, asking people to do things, to stay indoors, to stay in 5K. One of the most interesting commentators was Professor Lund from the ESRI. And he just talked about behaviours. And, you know, you have to have, you have to bring people with you as well. And the big stick doesn't always work. And, you know, you need to be able to say to people, we're doing this for the greater good. Here's why. And here's what you should do in your own house, in your own community. We got that right for a long time, but we did begin to veer away at one stage. And look, an effort have done well and have done their best. They are public health experts. They're not elected representatives. They're not people maybe used to dealing with the public. A couple of times they got it wrong and maybe rubbed people up the wrong way, telling people to do that a little bit more, you know, when people have been giving for months and months and months, etc. So look, I think, you know, they've had invaluable advice throughout, but we're getting to the stage where with the vaccination programme, as I say, really gathering steam at this stage, with things beginning to re-emerge into normal, that it's time to take other views to the table as well and look at that rounder perspective. And there is a cost to not doing certain things as well. You know, we could easily say to people, don't eat red meat, don't smoke, don't drink alcohol. And of course, yes, that would be public health advice and that would be endorsed by every public health official on the planet. But people may take a different view. And certainly
James,
butchers...
Could I ask you just on all that stuff in relation to NPHET, do you think at times there has been a problem with how the government has communicated the difference between what is public health advice and what is legally permissible? We've seen at times that certain things are legal, but NPHET is advising against them. And there seems to be some confusion in the public about that.
Yeah, massively so. Yeah, so I suppose I've seen that twice, actually. I saw it with the outdoor dining hospitality reopened last summer. And I saw it again when it began to reopen this summer. I had local publicans in my constituency saying to me, when they were allowed to reopen briefly last summer, they were just getting excited and opening up the shutters again and putting out their tables. And they saw comments by NPHET saying, please don't go to the pub, please don't go to the restaurant. And they said, is this conflicting advice? Now, actually, it's not really, because the NPHET have one perspective and one job, and that's to advise on the public health position. The government and other spokespeople have another job. So in any normal, in a non-COVID age, a public health official might say, you shouldn't drink alcohol, but there'll still be an ad and people will go to the local pub and have a drink and maybe they'll, you know, hopefully moderate their intake or whatever. But it's taken in as part of a rounder spectrum of advices and input and information that people can weigh up and make an informed decision on.
But does that lead to a lot of confusion then? Because we've heard, for example, in relation to travel, NPHET is telling people, if you're not fully vaccinated, you shouldn't really be travelling. Leo Varadkar, other members of government have said, well, you are allowed to travel and, you know, we're not going to stop you from travelling after July 19th. As long as you have this digital COVID certificate.
Sure. I think there's also a degree of individual responsibility here. So you may be allowed to do something. And again, I suppose we had a good discussion at committee on this about what the rules said, but what people may be expected to do. And they didn't always completely overlap. So, I mean, I've been asked by a number of people this summer as a local politician, look, should I go abroad or can I go abroad? And I said, well, yes, you can, but you probably shouldn't. And I said, that's a value call. That's a judgment call for people to make. You know, once the rules modify to the extent that people have that option, it doesn't mean they have to exercise it. And I would sort of say to people, look, use your discretion. Look at the facts. Look at look at where we are in terms of the overall program. Look at the disease rates abroad and make your own mind up. But my advice would be, if it was me, I wouldn't be going. So I think there's a bit of that has to come into it. So the public advice can be out there, but people don't have to take it, but probably they should certainly give a good consideration.
Where's the boundary on this one? Like, there's plenty of people who are concerned about the people who are in the 60-year-old cohort who haven't received the second vaccine. So is this another line that could be crossed in which the government would force either NIAC or NPHET to stop vaccinating the 30-year-olds, get into the 60-year-olds and make sure that they're all done if you believe that it is right?
Well, I suppose that there have been some challenges in that regard with the vaccine programme. One of them was about availability, because we reached a situation about 6 weeks ago where one of the vaccines was going to become available in large scale, but it wasn't suitable for the cohort that were about to be vaccinated next. Effectively, there was Pfizer was coming on stream, but the 60 to 69-year-olds were due to get the second jab of AZ, which wasn't in the country at the time. And that's exactly the scenario that I presented. Now, that has been brought down, I think it's from 12 weeks to 8 weeks. That has been brought forward. I think there was a realisation that with the Delta variant coming on track, that the first jab, even though I think it's 60 to 70% effective, may not be as effective against Delta, and that has been brought forward. But there have been times when the government has had to maybe lean on NIAC a little bit and say, guys, we could do with an answer. I know we were waiting for, again, go back about 2 months ago, there was another sort of crossroads in the vaccination programme. Could we give a particular vaccine to a particular cohort? And it would have been a real game changer if we could. It took about 3 weeks for NIAC to answer. And sometimes you wonder, is there a realisation that, you know, there are huge consequences of each of these decisions? And sometimes it's important to get moving on some of this stuff.
One last question, James, before we let you go. I noticed on Twitter that you had adopted a political prisoner from Belarus. Can you tell us about that person and what you hope to be able to do, given the dire straits in which the president of Belarus is talking about introducing martial law on account of EU sanctions?
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose I'm very worried geopolitically. The situation in Belarus is probably the most significant example in the European context. Russia is an aggressor, unfortunately. China is also an aggressor in an economic sense. I was delighted to see President Biden re-engaging with NATO and almost talking about a Southeast Asian NATO reaching out to allies like South Korea, Japan, and the Pacific region. Australia would be in there as well. I think that's maybe where the G7 needs to go to broaden out, maybe become a G10 as well. But in terms of Belarus in particular, I sit on the Foreign Affairs Committee. It's something I'd asked to go on in this term, something I'm very interested in. And the situation in Belarus is a huge affront to democracy, where a democratic opposition who won an election refused from taking office. The leader, of course, Svetlana, has significant Irish connections, spent many summers in the west of Ireland as one of the Chernobyl children through those connections. And I suppose all of Ireland, I suppose, really kind of wishes her on and wishes the opposition movement on. But those people have been charged in the streets by riot police, have been, in my case, the prisoner that I sponsored and supported was locked up. He was a trade union organiser, was also a journalist, was imprisoned, was locked away because of his political activities. This is happening in Europe. This is not happening in a far-flung state in furthest Africa, yeah, or in, you know, some corner of what we might consider the developing world. This is happening on our borders of the EU. I mean, and I suppose the other thing which obviously got a lot of attention was the Ryanair flight that was effectively taken down over Belarusian airspace and sort of held for 12 hours and let go again. I still don't think we have had anything near enough answers on that.
Yeah.
And I think really for international diplomacy, not to mention international aviation, that has to be sorted. I'm delighted to see Ireland on the Security Council. I think Minister Coveney was very strong on that. But I just think the international community really has to say to the Russians, to the likes of Belarus and the satellite states, you can't do this stuff. This is just such an affront to the international order. And I think we've really got to get serious about all this.
James Lawless, Fianna Fáil TD for North Kildare, thanks very much for joining us. And on that issue of Belarus, the opposition leader, according to the Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney, is going to be visiting Ireland next month and possibly appearing before the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs. Sandra, bringing it all back home, coming back to the issue of restrictions, we're already talking about it and it's a week away. What's your gut telling you about how things are going to go? People are looking at me, meeting me in the street and just over coffees are going, what do you think? And saying themselves, it doesn't look good, does it?
Yeah, I think that's the vibe at the moment, definitely, that it doesn't look good. And we will be talking about it every day until NPHET meets next Wednesday. We'll probably get some information maybe later that evening. The mood on Tuesday at Cabinet, both publicly and privately coming from ministers, seemed to be quite positive that, yes, the Delta numbers were ticking up, but at this stage, there was no reason to think that they wouldn't be able to go ahead with the next stage of reopening on July 5th. However, I think over the past 2 days, there's just a sense of a sort of a mood creeping in that things are getting a little darker. We know that the figures on Delta, the public figures, lag behind the real information. I think something that's certain here is that whatever NPHET says, the government will follow that advice. There won't be any deviation on this because it's too big. The other thing the government will be mindful of is that they won't want to reopen and then have to close again. So they'd want to be certain that when they're reopening on July 5th, that things actually happen. So I think it'll depend on the data over the next couple of days. There would be a big outcry from the sector if it didn't go ahead. But it really depends on NPHET.
Yeah, I mean, there was some rumbling we heard from the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party meeting last night about having to stand up to these health chiefs who for too long have had a big stick. But when it comes down to a decision like that, it's hard to see how the government would decide that it was going to open up everything if the hard advice from public health, from the chief medical officer was, don't mess it up now, let it roll on for another couple of weeks, the restrictions.
Exactly. It's just too big a decision. There is a certain logic that's been put out there by public health experts that delaying 2 to 3 weeks would really help because of the increase in vaccinations. There's sort of bumper levels of vaccinations at the moment. So I think all of that will be taken into consideration. It would, however, scupper what some might have seen as the plan in around July 5th, that it would help the feel-good factor in the run into the by-election. And the entire sector obviously would be very unhappy because it's peak season for them in terms of dining and all the rest of it. But things certainly worsening, but nothing's inevitable yet, I think. It just depends over the next while.
Yeah, I think the Taoiseach is going to be appearing on RT's The Week in Politics on Sunday, so we might get, once again, that might be the next sort of signpost as to whether or not things are changing. Bringing you back to the National Maternity Office Hospital and the question of the St. Vincent's site, it seems that the next step on that particular story will be the Health Minister engaging with the hospital group or healthcare group to try and find a way forward.
Yes, it's difficult to see what breakthrough could come from that because St. Vincent's seem they have resisted the political pressure around this. They were very clear in their statement on Tuesday that they believe they have to retain ownership of the site. Now, others have questioned the reasoning behind that. A lot rests, I suppose, on Stephen Donnelly in terms of trying to broker something here. It is an enormous project. Interesting what Leo Varadkar said in the Dáil today. He said kind of two things. He said they haven't given examination to alternative sites. And he also said they're not he's not aware of plans to look at alternative sites. So that seemed to move off the table. That suggestion that came from Dr. Peter Boylan that he'd had a private conversation with Simon Harris a few days ago. Simon Harris not disputing the content of that, but saying it was private. And during that conversation, according to Peter Boylan, Simon Harris suggested that Tala might be an option here. But for the moment, the government saying it's committed to the St. Vincent's site.
Yeah, one could imagine that Simon Harris felt rather awkward as the current Minister for Higher Education for it to be leaked out that he was offering health information and health strategy to someone of the standing of Peter Boylan as well. Nice and awkward.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's really the way to look at it. I don't think it's a massive big deal. It's just awkward because Simon Harris certainly retains an interest in health, let's say, and it's a little odd that they're having that type of conversation, so we're led to believe.
Yeah, one last thing on the politics of it. We were talking a little bit about Fine Gael and Leo Varadkar and how he was, to a certain degree, responsible for this sort of bubbling back up again. The Green Party, Nasa Harrigan, was out on Clare Byrne saying there needs to be moves, but she wasn't hard line, you know, no pulling of plugs. But for Fianna Fáil, for the Taoiseach, that big question of principle, you do get the sense, as you mentioned, being led by the Health Minister, that if there was a compromise that could be found in which the principle might apply next time, that's probably the way they'll go.
Yes, I think, you know, it is clear that the Taoiseach hasn't quite said that the longer lease is absolutely not an option. He hasn't ruled it out. We're told that Leo Varadkar said at the PP meeting last night, at the Fine Gael PP meeting, that it should be, the land should be publicly owned. He didn't quite say that in the Dáil today. And certainly, as I said earlier, Stephen Donnelly seems to suggest that while it's not the preferred option, the lease would be something he could work with. But I just think overall, politically, it's not going to fly at the moment. But I think everyone in government hoping that they can get to some sort of solution here. And I suppose the back and forth and the rhetoric over the past few days probably hasn't helped things either.
Yeah, I mean, those were the two big topics topics. We know that the question of restrictions is going to roll on for another week. Is there anything else that's standing out, or is it just restrictions going to suck the life out of everything else?
It really is the one that people care about, isn't it? It's real life stuff as opposed to everything else. I thought there was an interesting contribution in the Dáil on Tuesday from Catherine Murphy. She went back to Leo Varadkar's Ardesh speech, which James Lawless was talking about, and all those massive promises, that huge health spending, the housing, he mentioned sick pay, occupational pensions. I mean, it was just everything. And Catherine Murphy suggesting he'd found a new socialism, that he'd always been a Tory fiscal conservative. And she said that it was all sort of predicated on sort of vague promises around economic growth, because that's what Leo Varadkar said, it would all come from growth. Well, then he'd be happy reading the ESRI report this morning that says that the economy this year could grow by 11% as opposed to the 4-5% that he was citing at the weekend. Interesting, I think, also the timing of the Bank of Ireland announcement. Could this perhaps be feeding into a time when it would be beneficial to the government to bring in some extra money? It would help with all those, that budgetary arithmetic. And there is a political problem there for the government, because Sinn Féin and others very much saying, well, you're attempting to sell some of the shares at a time when they are depressed. They are well below their 2018 value, at perhaps 40-45% below that. And perhaps it's more of a political consideration for the government. They're certainly open to that accusation.
Yeah, it was interesting that it was announced that they were going to sell, as opposed to making an announcement that they'd sold, which was another question. But I did like that fact. It was like a reminiscing of Bertie Ahern and Joe Higgins, where Bertie went in and stole all of his socialist clothes, to see sort of a reprise of that as well. But anyway, we'll knock it on the head there. That was Sandra Hurley of our political unit. Thanks very much, Sandra. Our political guest this week was Fianna Fáil's James Lawless of North Kildare. Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Please do subscribe. Please do leave a comment. We love to hear from you. But until next time, take care.